podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Back in business. Hello and welcome to episode 7 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few weeks, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible few weeks of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, really good, thanks, Dan. Looking forward to the sort of real football kicking back off again this weekend, because as much as last night's game was good, these international breaks get a little bit tiring sometimes.
Yeah, it's good to chat about some proper football. Admittedly, we've been off for a couple of weeks. Main reason being the Queen and all of that. But also, I had a rare holiday last week, so it's good to be back from my point of view. But it's also good to be back for Luke, because Luke Connolly makes his debut on today's show. Luke, thanks for joining us this afternoon. I hope you're ready for plenty of football chat.
Certainly am, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. Right, before we do all that football chat, I'd best do some social media bits, otherwise we'll be talking into the abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at RealFootballPod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being BetRegal.com. For all the tips and predictions you'll need for the week ahead, visit their website. And the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. You get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? Let's mop up the biggest headlines in the Premier League over the past few weeks. And I think the biggest of them all is Graham Potter's switch to Chelsea. So, Cole, what do you make of the now former Brighton boss moving on to Stamford Bridge?
Yeah, I think it's a great move for him. When you look at his, you know, career trajectory, then I think it was important that when an opportunity like this comes along, he's taken it. I think you could sit there and say that he has earned it, an opportunity, because, you know, all the time we sit there when these big jobs come along, and more often than not, you know, one of these type of managers, you know, you think they might be in with a chance, but then they just don't get the job, and we sit there going, well, you know, will these English managers get given an opportunity? And Chelsea have done that. And like I say, when you look at what he's achieved at Brighton and the way that they played football, I think if you're a Chelsea fan, it's something to be quite excited about. And they'll be hoping that they can finally, you know, put a plan in place where they might stick with a manager and not do the sort of change in the way it has done in the past, even though you can't knock it because it's worked for them. But it looks like there's a change of tact at Chelsea. And, you know, to be honest, I am slightly jealous, because Potter was one of those managers that, you know, he was someone that I wouldn't have minded if Spurs had gone and appointed him before Conte. And also sitting there thinking that if Conte was to leave at any point soon or in the next year, then he would have been one of those people that I would have said would have been top of my list. So I think it's a great move all round. Now we just need to wait and see whether he can actually go there and do the job that he's been doing at Brighton, but just on a grander scale.
Well, Luke, I guess from Potter's point of view, he was never going to be any hotter than right now. I mean, when your stock's that high, you almost have to take those opportunities when they come around. Yes, it would have been more noble to stay at Brighton, being where they are, fourth in the league at the moment. I know it's early, but still, top four is very impressive for the Seagulls. So you can't really begrudge Potter moving on as he has.
No, probably not, no. I think when a Champions League club come knocking, I think there's only so much persuasion you need, really. He was linked with Everton last year and he didn't jump ship then. And I think that's kind of proved dividends for him at the moment. He's still very well at Brighton as well, and he's with a fairly kind of modest kind of backing, but a very well-balanced squad. They're all tidy footballers at Brighton if you look throughout the team. I think they play some really good stuff. And, you know, he's actually managed that transition, I think, from Chris Eaton, where they were playing quite defensive football, and they did manage to stay in the Premier League, but they've become quite an expansive, attractive team to follow and watch. And I think from another point of view is that they'll have looking at the way that they kind of appoint managers over and over again, is that generally speaking, they have, apologies for what I'm saying there, they have they play a 3-4-2-1 formation quite rigidly, which kind of fits in the way with the way Chelsea have been built since Conte, really. And yeah, it bodes well for him, I think.
Now, Cole, at the same time, we mustn't forget that Thomas Tuchel is the man who has shown the exit door recently. £250 million was spent over the summer. Does that suggest that the owner had a far greater influence when it came to recruitment?
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because, you know, you sit there and think, you know, having gone through that summer, I know, obviously, you know, we're hearing the stories, aren't there, that, you know, Tuchel just wasn't happy with the role he was given and that in the summer and didn't want to be as involved with that in transfers. So you have got to sit there and maybe say that the owner possibly has had a bigger say than what they might have done over previous years. Tuchel, I don't think it suited him. And obviously, ultimately, they've agreed that, well, look, listen, this isn't working. We'll part ways. Now, you could say, as the owner come in with that kind of idea in mind pretty early doors, he's not afraid to say what he wants, the owner, is he? As I'm sure we might get onto that later on in the pod as well. But, yeah, it was a little bit strange to go and think you might have spent all that money in bringing in those players that a certain manager wants, and then with 5 minutes later, you're bringing someone new in who may look at those players and think, not for me, you know, I'm looking, you know, I'm thinking more around the likes of someone like Aubameyang, because that is a transfer where we know that guy kind of upsets people. He's got that reputation. Tuchel probably wanted him because he's worked with him, but will Graham Potter? And if he doesn't, that's a big character. It's big money, and someone that could upset the apple cart as the season goes on if he isn't in Graham Potter's plan. So it was a bit bizarre, and it didn't really make sense. But I think the owner obviously has a vision where he wants to take the club, and ultimately didn't see Tuchel as being part of those plans.
Well, let's talk about the owner now, Luke, because obviously Todd Boehly as now at the helm. We talk about the change of mindset in terms of managerial turnover. That's what Cole alluded to. Do you reckon that will be the case? Is Potter Todd Boehly's man? And now, that's not to say that Potter gets a free hit. He's still got to perform. But is there an element of patience that might be given to the former Brighton manager? It might be the fact that he gets, I don't know, 2-3 years to implement his true plan. Or would it be, once again, heads on the chopping block if things aren't delivered?
Yeah, I think my early indication is that they want quite a bit of involvement in the decision-making, which, as Carl said, I don't think Thomas Tuchel was particularly happy with. He's pretty reluctant to actually be micromanaging that kind of way. You would think that Graham Potter is probably less of an ego than some of the big European managers at the moment. He's probably a bit more subservient to that. I think ultimately that there shouldn't really be a huge transition in the way Chelsea play moving from one manager to the other. And results will tell. And I think the way that they're kind of structuring the club is probably to give him a bit more of a purely coaching role and to have less of a sort of role in the transfer market, which is, you know, feeds into that idea of having bought people like Aubameyang and, you know, whether one manager would want them and one wouldn't. I think that Potter's probably going to be given more of a coaching role to do with that. And those kind of decisions will be made at more of an upstairs level. So ultimately, I think it'll be down to results. And I think he'll at least get through this transfer window, maybe have some say in who they actually sign, and probably get to the end of the year and they'll go from there, I suspect.
Now, when it comes to patience, Cole, the Chelsea supporters weren't offering much during their draw against RB Salzburg in the Champions League. Now, do you think the boos were more placed at the board's decision to sack Tuchel rather than the installation of Potter?
I seriously hope so, because, you know, I dread to think if we've suddenly, you know, come to a day and age where supporters are not even prepared to give a manager sort of a week to bed in and start getting their ideas across. So I don't believe that there was any animosity towards Graham Potter there. I probably find it was a little bit more aimed towards maybe the players or the club in the way that things have been done, just to try and sort of let them know, well, listen, you know, we're not entirely that happy with the way things have started for us. I can't believe there would have been, you know, I know on Talk Sport, I think you had Jason Cundy saying he wasn't that impressed with Potter in that first game. And you just go, oh, please, come on. You know, I mean, what we thought Watford were bad enough. But when a club starts turning to one game and 1 week in charge and they start disvoicing their pleasure, I think that would be a really worrying place. But I don't think supporters are that, you know, that far gone yet. It will take him a little while to get in there, get his ideas across. I think the break that they've probably had, apart from this international break where he would have lost most of his squad, would have helped, because, you know, he's had more time on the training pitch than matches come in thick and fast. Because, yes, you know, ultimately, if he suddenly goes on a run of four or five defeats and not picking up a win, then pressure does start to mount reasonably early. But I think they'll see him through and give him enough time. And, you know, you've got to give him at least this full season to start to see, is there any progress here? And is this man potentially able to step up and manage big egos and a big club? But I think he'll be fine.
Yeah, I mean, you would honestly like to think those boos aren't because of Potter being in charge after one day, but the way football fans are going, there probably is a small sentiment who did actually want Potter booed after a day. But it is what it is in that sense. Luke, when we look at the direction of where these boos are coming from, will they dissipate rather quickly if Chelsea start winning rather quickly? Is this just another sign of football fans being incredibly fickle?
Yeah, definitely. I think we had a similar situation when Mourinho left and they had the free rats banner with Hazard spelt wrong,
says
Costa spell written on a bed sheet. And ultimately, yeah, I think that once he actually starts to pick up a few results, it'll dissipate completely. Because as you've said, you know, the frustration really is aimed pretty exclusively at the ownership, I would imagine. And they've just bought the club for, what was it, £3 billion? So they're not going to go anywhere. Your options are fairly limited if you're unhappy in that respect, I guess.
Now let's move on to Brighton, because although they took some time to replace Graham Potter, Roberto De Zerbi has now been installed at the Amex. Now, Carl, it's going to be something of an unknown quantity to the majority of Brighton fans, but you would imagine that Tony Bloom, the owner, will have certainly done his due diligence beforehand.
Yeah, I think they're a well-run club, aren't they, Brighton? Yeah. And, you know, given the way that Potter has sort of overachieved with them over the last couple of years, I think if you're any sensible owner, you know this has been coming. So the ultimate thing here is, right, listen, you know, we need to make sure we've got that backup plan, because if this guy continues to impress, a big club is going to come knocking, and we need to make sure we've not been caught short by that and we suddenly don't know where we're going next. I think they've got a philosophy and a way that they want the club to go. They've probably looked at managers who do a similar thing or want to play a similar way. So I kind of think with the way Brighton are run, I'm kind of confident in the fact that they've probably brought in a man who might be able to sort of emulate and kind of keep what Graham Potter's started there going. I guess the biggest fear that they would have had and that you always have is that suddenly, you know, when a manager leaves, you suddenly get gutted of your coaching staff and things like that. So that might be a slight concern. But I am confident that, you know, Brighton have probably done their homework on this and been prepared for this for at least a couple of seasons. So I think you've got to feel confident that they probably know what they're doing. But time will tell, obviously.
I guess, Luke, with the appointment being of this nature, Brighton will be hoping for evolution rather than revolution on the South Coast. And when you consider what the Seagulls are likely to achieve at the end of the season, does it give De Zerbi a bit of a buffer when it comes to adapting to the Premier League? And what I mean by that is, when you take Graham Potter going to Chelsea, he's going to have to get top four for it to be a success. The pressure is on him. The new Brighton boss, if he finishes 12th, it's not the end of the world. Obviously, they want to finish in the top half. They might even want to break the glass ceiling and get into Europe. That's probably wishful thinking, but there's not as much pressure, so it probably gives him a bit more time to adjust to a new league.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, again, very similar to the Potter appointment at Chelsea, I don't think you'll see a huge divergence in the way Brighton play, but I think it's a really good appointment for Brighton. I think it shows how much they've grown as a club, really. This is a guy with quite a big reputation in European circles. I think Pep Guardiola was particularly complimentary when he signed earlier. I think he'd previously been linked with the Juventus job as well. At Shakhtar, he did a pretty good job under pretty difficult circumstances. They're expected to win that league, but bear in mind that they've been playing in Kiev for half of the season before it was cancelled. And now, obviously, they're playing in Poland. And it's a swallow, which is probably the best point of comparison you've got from against Brighton. In moving to Brighton, is it was a pretty a club in Italy with a fairly modest reputation, who had playing some pretty expansive, remarkable football, and they were turning up quite a few trees in Serie A. People like Berardi and Locatelli playing for them, who are now, you know, stalwarts in the Italian team. So I expect him to do fairly well. Like you say, though, I think he'll be given a period of time. He'll be given a transfer window before going into summer, and at that point, you'll probably have a good expectation how Brighton will evolve under him.
Now, Carl, you mentioned about Potter taking his coaching team with him, and that's always that kind of transitional period between new staff coming into a club. Is that going to be an issue for Brighton? Now, will they be able to pick up largely where they left off? I mean, they've got Liverpool at the weekend. We talk about new manager bounce. Are you expecting anything that quickly, or are they going to sort of struggle under new management and getting to grips with a new coaching team?
I guess it's a great time to play Liverpool in a way, just after the international break, isn't it? Because, you know, everyone's just suddenly filtering back in from where they've been away. So they might not have had a chance to kind of get themselves set and ready. There's obviously not been, you know, the best start. They've been a little bit hit and miss, Liverpool, so far this season. So I kind of think it's a great game to start with because, you know, as a new manager, you go in, you're not favourites. You know, no one would be surprised if Brighton lost the game. So I think as a new manager, it's not the worst start you'd want, you know, given the whole like timing and that of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see an upset this weekend. I certainly could put it on the cards because if Brighton have been able to have most of their squad around over the international break and been able to prepare themselves, and, you know, as we think that if Brighton have done their job properly, they're bringing in a really good manager, I wouldn't be surprised to see Brighton go and nick something this weekend. And that then sets the ball rolling perfectly, doesn't it? And as you're saying, you know, this guy will be given time. You know, as you said, at Chelsea, Graham Potter's got expectations to, you know, do well in the Champions League, be challenging for top four, even, you know, and even more. So that is pressure. I think the new guy there will find the club that are prepared to let him bed in, get himself sorted. And, you know, a couple of early defeats, I don't think that would knock them or not the confidence at all. So I actually think this is a great time. And like I say, I see Brighton pulling off a bit of a shock this weekend.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be the biggest shock in terms of the week. I think it's there for the taking, as you say, Carl. I mean, maybe a draw. They might not get all 3 points, but Liverpool just haven't got that, I guess, aura, that lure to them as they did at Anfield for the last 2-3 seasons. It's not the fortress it once was. So they could be there for the taking. But Luke, going back to the installation of Brighton's new manager, De Zerbi, is it going to be similar to how Swansea used to operate in the Premier League, in the sense that Brendan Rodgers moved on, then Michael Laudrup came in, and it's just nothing really changed in terms of system or ethos? The manager changed, but the system largely stayed the same?
I suspect so, yeah. I think the players he's got, I think I mentioned earlier, they've got a very tidy set of footballers there at Brighton. They play some good stuff. It would be nonsense to bring in a Sam Allardyce, for instance, and expect them to, you know, adapt quickly. I think this guy will actually adapt and take them up a notch, to be totally honest. Yeah, it's interchangeable, but I suppose when you play, spend such an amount of money on a playing squad, it would make sense to chop and change a manager, you know, when you've invested so heavily. And I think you won't see a huge amount of difference this season, perhaps over time. I think he'll probably prefer a back four rather than a back five, although he'll probably have to adapt for the interim. But ultimately, I think the general feel, the general style will stay constant.
Right, let's stay on the South Coast now, as Bournemouth are still without a manager at the time of recording. And Carl, with Gary O'Neill having picked up 5 points from the first nine on offer to him, if you were in charge, would you be tempted to give him the job full time, or is this simply a case of anything just being more positive than Scott Parker?
Yeah, that's a tough one, isn't it? Because obviously, you know, you get the impression they're waiting because they know that there might be this takeover coming. And obviously, you know, there's no point appointing a man and then a new owner comes in and he's got his own ideas. It just brings more chaos to the club. I'm not so sure I'd give, you know, Gary O'Neill the job. You know, I think if you're Bournemouth and you're looking, you know, you've maybe just had a takeover and you're looking to stay in the Premier League, I think you're looking at bringing in a more experienced man that you think might have the calibre to get you over the line. it's probably been, like as you say, Dan, you know, Scott Parker obviously wasn't very happy given the way that this, you know, pre-season and everything went and what he was being given to do the job. So you maybe sort of think, was there like the greatest atmosphere? And sometimes, you know, if there is a cloud looming over that moving on, it could be anyone's voice, couldn't it? Just someone different suddenly brings a fresh set of legs and a different perspective. But I think if you're Bournemouth, I'll be expecting them, I think, to make a bigger name signing and bringing someone in that they feel might have the experience to get them over the line. Because let's face it, it's going to be a long, tough season for them. So you want to kind of know and feel confident that you roughly might have the right man at the helm who's gone through it, knows what he's doing, and can actually achieve the job that you might want him to achieve.
Well, Luke, at the time of recording, Gary O'Neill is only second favourite in terms of the betting odds because the new favourite is Chris Wilder. So he's not having the best season at Middlesbrough, not really landing a punch in terms of the playoffs or anything like that at the moment, but he does have Premier League experience. So if you were in charge of Bournemouth, would you see him making the switch to the Vitality?
Yeah, you made a good point there about Middlesbrough not having the best of seasons. I think pre-season, everybody was kind of expecting them to be towards the top end of that table. I think 4-4-2 actually predicted them to win the league. But it's a long season, the Championship, and who's to say, you know, he wouldn't have turned it around. But I think that they probably will end up looking at Chris Wilder. I think the other thing that we've not considered, I guess, is the fact that they've signed Tavernier from Middlesbrough for quite a bit of money.
Good shout.
Who did very well under Wilder, and I don't know if they are targeting that as such, but it would certainly be a boon for hiring him. I think timing's key as well. I think you mentioned the new manager at Brighton coming in at potentially a difficult time for Liverpool as well. I think timing's key for Bournemouth, really. The next game's Brentford at home. I think if O'Neill wins that, assuming that he's still in charge, there's a chance he'll stay. But equally, I've got the next four games down as Leicester at home, Fulham away, Southampton at home, West Ham away. And looking at current form, they're all, if not winnable, certainly Bournemouth will be targeting winning them if there's any ambition to stay up. So you would potentially argue it's a good time to bring in a Chris Wilder, who you think could build some momentum during that period. I would say I could see him making that switch. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a feasible switch, but as Cole alluded to, there is a bit of a logjam now because you've got this cloud of new ownership lurking over the Vitality Stadium. So does this issue, Cole, put off the likes of Sean Dyche? Because he was favourite a week or so ago, maybe even further back than that. So he's gone down to third or fourth in the odds at the moment. So is he looking at the situation thinking, well, I don't know who's going to be the owner. If I take the job now, American owners might come in. I've already had my fingers burnt by American owners at Burnley. I don't really fancy this again. So is this sort of slowing things down in terms of recruitment?
Yeah, it could do, couldn't it? Because like as you say, if you're any manager and you suddenly think the ownership might be changing, there is that fear that if you're brought in before that, you know, does the new man actually want you? And suddenly, before you know it, not too long after getting your foot in the door, you're suddenly finding that you're being booted out of it pretty quickly. As you say, with Dyche, you know, he might be sitting there thinking, well, listen, I've seen what the American ownership model brings, and yes, I'm not too sure I want to go back there. Also, I think with someone like Sean Dyche, he's probably sitting there thinking, you know, I've got a reasonably decent reputation in the game, and do I want to put myself in what could be a relegation dogfight with a team that's probably not up to it? And then obviously, if I then take them down, my reputation, you know, falls even further away. And then, you know, a manager that was once being touted for bigger jobs suddenly finds people going, well, actually, yeah, you know, maybe this guy is not the sort of real deal that people like to think he was. So I do think that change of owner will possibly have stalled what they've been doing, and people will just need to wait and see what happens when that finally, you know, that takeover finally does happen, and then they'll move in the direction they want to.
Well, you make a very good point about Sean Dyche and getting back in. If you look at what Eddie Howe did, left Bournemouth under the circumstances of getting relegated. I know it was a kind of mutual departure, but that era ended. And it would have been very easy for Howe to go back in quickly. But he bided his time because he didn't want to ruin his own stock. His stock was already quite low because of that relegation. And you can't afford another dent to that. You can take time out and kind of almost be forgettable. But by not managing, you're not doing much damage. And then he got the Newcastle job. and look at him now. So it's kind of sometimes it pays to be patient. And I think you're right in terms of Sean Dyche. He could walk into that Bournemouth job quite easily. But does he need to? You know, has he earned another job up the hierarchy? Constantly linked with Everton and the likes. You know, West Ham might come about if it all goes wrong for David Moyes in a few months' time, because they're not having the greatest start to the season. So perversely, managers love to get back in, but they also know when to sit on the sidelines. But Luke, if we sort of expand on the point about American ownership, if and when this takeover takes place at Bournemouth, we're going to have just three clubs in the Premier League which have no major international ownership. So that's Brighton, Brentford. Now, they are due to Tony Bloom and Bentham, I can't remember his first name, they're sort of gambling powerhouses, you know, they're just kind of data gurus and they know what they're doing. So they bought a football club. And then you've got Enix. So you've got three clubs out of 20 if Bournemouth also go to an American owner. Is this ultimately healthy for the Premier League?
And yeah, half of those teams in the Premier League, if not being majority owned by Americans, will be at least partially owned. Yep. It would have been healthy for the league. You've got to ask yourself, I suppose, why does Bill Foley want to buy Bournemouth? And ultimately, it's down to the fact that Sterling's weak and there are substantial TV revenues coming in. For him, I guess it's just an investment opportunity. And really, the weakness of the fit and proper testing, the lack of an enforced fan ownership model with them involved in decision making means that it's they're able to be exploited in this way. Ultimately, these are capitalists, aren't they? They're not interested in a sporting pyramid built on merit. And you'll increasingly see the Premier League become more and more of a closed shop. I know we'll probably come to some of your points on that, but it's no secret that FSG at Liverpool and the Glazers at United were pushing for the Super League. And really, the rest of these, the teams that really jumped on that under a fear of missing out, really, in self-interest. But, you know, like I say, the more that these clubs are treated as investment opportunities rather than clubs and community-run clubs, you'll end up in a position where they are treated as such and there'll be more self-interest in the league and not for the good of the league or the good of the game, unfortunately.
Well, this is the case because, Carl, if Bournemouth gets taken over by American owners, and we're not singling out Bournemouth, but it just is another club in that column, shall we say, does it then add more weight to those kind of ideas that are thought up that you are quite hard to stomach by English football fans? Let's take the North versus South game, which was announced recently. If we consider that as a red herring, whether that gets off the ground is pretty much immaterial. However, another American voice around the Premier League board table adds more weight to the 39th game, doesn't it? All those kind of things that we've kind of gone, oh God, not this. They're only going to get closer in the limelight if more American and international owners come to the fore.
Yeah, that's right, because it's the votes as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've only got to get a certain amount of votes to bring stuff in. And as we're saying, you know, these guys are just going to look at ways, well, how can we make more money? How can we kind of make sure we're safer from that fact that, you know, I mean, when you look at the American sport, you know, no promotion or no relegation, you know, an owner sits there basically making sure my, you know, investment is never in doubt of going pear-shaped here because, you know, we're safe. Nothing too bad can happen. And all those ideas of the 38th game, you know, Dubai and places like that, they will all get muted and there's, you know, it'll slowly turn around to more and more clubs going, well, yeah, we're up for this because if it brings more revenue in, you know, it's a bit like the NFL now, isn't it, Dan? You know, the actual, you know, as we know with our stadium, the actual league games are being moved abroad and they're going around the world with actual, not just glorified friendlies, but actually meaningful games. And if you're, you know, if you're a Spurs, Liverpool, Man United supporter, you know, to suddenly find that three or four of your games are now in Dubai this season, it's just like, oh, well, that's great. You know, as you say, as we said earlier, the club isn't a club for the fans anymore. You know, it's a club for the owners. So we do have to be, you know, we do have to be careful of what's going on. And it's sort of worrying because I think we'll see the Super League rear its head again. I think, you know, as we said, you know, we were going to be involved because we didn't want to miss out. But there'll be more and more of these ideas put forward, as say the North and South All-Star games and stuff like that. And it just becomes a circus in the end, doesn't it?
Well, it does indeed. And Luke, we're not there yet, but could you envisage a scenario where all the 20 Premier League teams are no longer English owned? And if so, does that bring the prospect of a European Super League even closer to home?
Yeah, unfortunately so. I think we started to see this really, it's all stemmed from Abramovich's involvement really initially. You then had a string of owners who were trying to sell clubs to people like the Glazers and Hicks and Gillette, who were ultimately not in a position to be dealing with those kind of sums of wealth and those kind of characters. You'll end up in a position where I think the European Super League is unfortunately going to rear its head again. Because ultimately, if you're investing in a company and you know, let's take investing in Chelsea, for example, if they're budgeting to guarantee that they're going to qualify for the Champions League this year, then that's just bad business because there's no guarantee that they will qualify. So from their point of view, a closed shop makes more sense from a financial perspective. But the European Super League itself is actually a pretty bad concept, really. It's good for the kind of global fan, I suppose, but for the match-going fan, it actually dilutes things. And it's actually, if you're playing Bayern Munich or Barcelona 3 or 4 times a year, is that really good? Is that, you know, is that something that the fans ultimately want? And for me, the answer is no. We're starting to see it with the Champions League anyway. It's the same teams playing each other every week. The Europa League is actually more interesting in terms of the kind of combinations of teams you get.
Yeah, it's a very valid point, actually. And I guess with plans of a European Super League, it's always reared its head. I mean, there's always someone speculating, trying to make more money. For as long as I've been a football fan, 30-odd years, there's always been that idea, that German idea of European Super League, but it's never got there yet. And I think that it's all about getting the right idea. The concept's not necessarily wrong, it's all about how you sell it. And I think if you kind of look at last season's plans, was it the season before, if you water them down slightly, you'd get a bit more traction, and then you go again, that might get pushed back, you try again, and it's like, oh, actually, do you know what, it's not such a bad idea, because all these new owners that are taking over Premier League clubs, and that's how you kind of see the map and the pathway come to fruition. But at the same time, Cole, we haven't got a European Super League, but if you drop the word European, we probably have got a Super League because of the Premier League. Now, when you consider the strength of our offering, do Premier League teams actually need to walk away, or is it just that constant desire to find a bit more money?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, then, you know, in terms of league as such, you know, we probably have got one of the strongest leagues in the world, haven't we? Because we, you know, you do have that element of not knowing, you know, no game is a given, you know, even if you're playing a team bottom of the league, they can still throw a surprise, and all the clubs in the league have been able to spend the sort of money that means they can bring in quality players. So I don't think you'll find a stronger league in the world. I guess it's all about that global market, isn't it? And as you rightly say, Dan, you know, I think with these guys taking over, it's more about the money. And ultimately, I think on a global scale, you know, Chelsea playing Real Madrid will earn Chelsea a lot more money than, say, Chelsea playing Bournemouth on the weekend or during midweek. So ultimately, I think if you're the owner, it is around, well, what is a more global experience and globally going to earn me more money? And it would be those glamours, you know, what people think as glamour ties. But I completely agree with Luke. You know, if you had that Super League, I think fans would soon get bored of that idea, because I think the glamour of those big fixtures is the fact that they don't come around every week. So when you do draw one of those big sides, it suddenly brings an excitement. You know, I go back to when we played Real Madrid at Wembley, Dan.
Yep.
That was probably one of the best nights I've had for a long while, because, you know, we'd spent ages trying to get into that competition, and suddenly you had one of the world footballing powers come along, and there was just a buzz and excitement. If you have that every week, I think it just dilutes, and fans suddenly get a little bit tired of it, especially when that comes at the cost of your sort of national game and things like grassroots. I think football fans would soon turn on that.
Absolutely. And I guess, Luke, we can also highlight the Premier League spending power across the course of the transfer window. When you look at what the Premier League spent and you look at the other four leagues as part of the Big Five, those four leagues didn't even get close to the Premier League. Now, that's just highlighting a further imbalance across Europe as a whole.
It is, massively so. And this is why I think you've seen Barcelona really having to scratch around for investment ideas and short selling all of the financial assets, which, you know, you ended up with football fans who are watching European football becoming almost Financial Times readers trying to explain how Barcelona have managed to get a transfer budget for the upcoming season. It is, and it's not good for the game in the long run, you know. And that's, in a way, why you will see people like the Agnellis who own Juventus, Barcelona, Real Madrid, all pushing for a European Super League, because they're seeing the revenues streaming in, and in the long run, they won't be able to compete, unfortunately.
Well, maybe it needs a kind of bit more outside-of-the-box thinking. Let's revolutionise this concept of the European Super League. The Premier League doesn't really need the European clubs. The European clubs need the Premier League. Now, if you look at a sport like, I don't know, baseball, for example, you have two conferences, and although everyone sort of plays everyone, there's two separate leagues and kind of divisions in those leagues. So what if we took, I don't know, the top eight clubs in the Premier League, they broke away, and then we took the eight best European clubs, and we had those 16 clubs playing each other, but in two sort of separate league tables, so on and so forth. Is that something that could work, Carl, where we don't really see a European Super League as such, we actually see the European clubs team up because they need stronger leagues themselves, so actually they might actually form their own league, which then matches the power of the Premier League?
Yeah, I see the idea. I just ultimately think that football fans don't want to see it. You know, I think no matter what, you know, nation or, you know, country you're in, I think your own football leagues become very, you know, that's what you love about the game, isn't it? You know, those fans in Italy want to see the Serie A, you know, the Serie B. I don't think that football fans want to see that type of football. I think they're happy with the way, you know, yes, we've got our European tournaments where then you suddenly, you know, you earn a right to be in them, and then you'll get those sort of European nights that you go away for. I think that's what fans crave. So ultimately, I don't think anyone wants it apart from the men that can make money. And if it was to kick off, then I think after, you know, a season or so of it, I think you'd have fans calling that they want things just to return to the way they were.
Yeah, I mean, I don't make you wrong, but at the same time, Luke, is it a sense that we're in a bit of a logjam in Europe in that you look at PSG? I know they've not won every season since their Qatar takeover, but they win almost every season. Bayern Munich, 10 in a row. I know they've lost last weekends, and then also haven't won any of the last four. So they're going through a very rare blip, but they are still the powerhouse. Juventus won 9 in a row. I know things have slightly changed there. But the point I'm trying to make is we've kind of got leagues that are hosting clubs that are too big for themselves, but a European Super League is probably the wrong answer. So how do we fix all this hyper-dominance across Europe?
I think ultimately in the long run, the money just needs to be weaned out of the game, really. We need to wean ourselves off of it. And the only way you would have that in the long run would be to have enforced fan ownership of at least a sizable portion of each club. Otherwise, the revenue money will talk and the revenues will come first. You know, the other options that have been mooted, I guess, would have been regionalised sort of super leagues. I know there was Atlantic league that was mooted between, I think it was Belgium, Holland, even I think Celtic Rangers were looking joining as well. And, you know, Scandinavia potentially. I know they've had some fairly decent performances on Bodo Glimt, etc., in the Conference League. But, you know, going back to it, it's a very poor concept for the match going fan, and it will get to the point where the concept is so diluted that it it'll just be for TV audiences, and then we'll see, as we saw over COVID, when the fans aren't behind a team, or they are merely treated as sort of customers rather than fanatical supporters, is you'll get to a point where the game you're watching is diluted, and eventually people will switch off.
Well, let's talk about the balance now between the Premier League and the EFL. And Carl, once again, talks of a deal with Reed the Head. It seems to always be conveniently in an international break, whether they try and sweep it under the carpet. But it's about funding for the pyramids. And yes, that's always a good thing, should it come about. But it always comes at a price. And it seems as one of the costs now is FA Cup third and fourth round replays getting the boot. Is this something of an easy target, in your opinion?
Yeah, I, you know, It's a hard one, isn't it? Because I guess clubs, you know, clubs will say that, you know, they don't mind those replays, or the bigger clubs won't mind those replays, but the smaller clubs like the idea of them. And it is always nice that, you know, you, that sort of smaller side could end up getting a fight in a draw and get to go and play at one of the big grounds, isn't it? So I'm not in favour of scrapping those replays. But I think, as we've always said over the years we've been speaking, haven't we, Dan, these cup competitions are the first things that, you know, people are going to look at and suddenly go, well, look, we can make changes here. We said, I think maybe a couple of seasons ago, didn't we, that we wondered if the Carabao Cup would still be around at a certain point, or whether the clubs would just decide that they'd prefer just to scrap that tournament altogether. It still seems to be here, but that wouldn't surprise me at some point if that, you know, that sort of like was to rear its head, where it's like, well, actually, do we need the League Cup? You know, do the big clubs want to be involved in it? So I think the cups are always the first thing that people look at, but ultimately you'll then find that come FA Cup time, people are saying, has the magic of the FA Cup gone? Well, yeah, the magic kind of has gone because you've messed around with it too much. But, you know, I can see those sorts of things and those replays being scrapped because it fits into those people that don't want to have replays.
Well, this is it. I mean, if you took, I don't know, a League One, League Two club, there's two-sided arguments to this. On one side, they lose the replays, which can be the lifeblood of a season or two to follow. I mean, I remember it was Exeter, got a draw against Liverpool at home, got a replay, loads of money. That kept them, you know, swimming above the sea level. That's great. That's a great success story. But you could also argue that if there's no replays, a team like Exeter might beat Liverpool in penalties and then go through to the next round. So from a sporting perspective, it might level the playing field a little bit further. You know, there are swings and roundabouts, but it's always death by a thousand cuts. And the same, Luke, is going to be for the EFL Cup, because they have once again been caught in the crosshairs when it comes to chops. And as Carl rightly says, we've been sort of banging this drum for quite a while now. Not that we want it, but we just see it happening. So in this latest round of discussions, there's talk of European entrants who are competing in the Champions League, Europa Conference League, being allowed to either pull out completely or just enter an under 21 team, such as how Liverpool did when they had to be in Qatar and Aston Villa at the same place. So if that happens, is that the death knell of the tournament for you?
I mean, they're doing it anyway.
Yeah, really. That's true, yeah.
You know, whether you look at them doing, I know that instance with Liverpool and Villa, it was consecutive games, wasn't it? And let's be fair, would any other team have acted differently? I don't think they probably would. I think, given the chance that it's a Club World Cup, they probably would have gone for it. But in any case, on normal fixtures in that tournament, more often than not, it's at the very least a rotated team. And you know, if you don't, as a club, if you don't want to prioritise that tournament, then enter a weaker team. And then, so what? You know, let's see a team from mid-table, lower down in the Premier League, get to Wembley, get to a final. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, really. It'll actually make it a bit more marketable than Man City winning it every year, really. I suppose the only thing I would say for the League Cup is I've never understood the two-legged semi-final structure, whether that's good or bad for it, I don't really know. And I know in the past, I think David Moyes, it was, actually raised a pretty good point about it, saying that he would like to make it into a British Cup, invite teams from Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland. There's a bit of a sort of revamp for it. I don't know if that's necessarily required, but, you know, the tournament's there and it exists. It shouldn't be played around with willy-nilly just for the whims of, you know, there being too many calendared fixtures, which are really kind of enforced on them by increasing Champions League games, increasing World Cup games. It exists and we should just get on with it, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of good points there. Carl, let's pick up one in the sense that if the likes of Man City and Liverpool were playing their under-21s and everyone knew that was the case, there wouldn't be a pretense of, actually, we're just going to play 10 youth team players anyway. This is the team we're going to put out. It might allow the likes of West Ham and Newcastle to actually win silverware. So although you might not see the very best teams in action, it's going to open it up to more people. Is that a positive for you?
Yeah, I guess so. I think, yeah, I mean, obviously as a Spurs fan who wants a trophy, then yeah, get Man City out of it as quick as possible. Yeah, that'd be great. But yeah. Like as we've said, you know, there are certain teams, you know, Arsenal used to do it, didn't they? Where it was like, you know, you could beat Arsenal in the League Cup, and yes, you had some bragging rights, but then you always got it thrown in your face of, well, yeah, but you did only beat our kids, so it's nothing really to crow about. And I guess that'll be the only thing some supporters would feel, you know, that would be Spurs' luck, that the year Man City and Liverpool filled those teams, we'd win it, and then it'll always just be held against us. Yeah, but you've kind of won it by default, so you're not that great a side, and it doesn't really count. But as we've said, you know, it would be good to see someone different stand a chance of winning those trophies than seeing Man City go and win it as their kind of like season warm-up, wouldn't it, every year? I do agree that, you know, the two-legged semi-finals, I think that kind of, that needs to go, because that does seem like an unnecessary game when you can just have neutral venues, a bit like the FA Cup semi-finals. And that probably adds a little bit more excitement, you know, because we've had times in there where you've seen first legs finish like 6-0 and you're going, well, what is the point of this next game? So there are certain ways you could revamp it rather than scrap it altogether. But I see the bigger teams possibly liking the idea that they can either pull out or openly field youth sides in there.
And Luke, you mentioned a British Cup. That could be perhaps a precursor to regionalised European leagues. You know, try a cup first. Let's sort of take the United Kingdom as a sample. I guess the problem is the Premier League might feel it's a bit beneath them. So you might see the likes of Man City under-21s versus Kilmarnock. You know, I get the concept, but is it going to be a strong enough spectacle to sell?
Probably not, if I'm being totally honest. I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea.
No.
In terms of the marketability of, you know, from a match-going fan perspective, getting to go to Celtic Park or Ibrox or, you know, north of the border for just a day out more than anything. But again, where does it fit in the calendar? And, you know, the moment you start to say Liverpool are entering their under-21s, Man City are entering their under-21s, rather than it being, oh yeah, Liverpool are in the tournament but they've played a weaker team, the moment you start to actually physically say it's their under 21 side, you immediately diminish the viability of it. I think if they do move towards that, it will eventually die out, and I think the cup will go eventually if they do that.
Well, Carl, I guess the EFL are constantly stuck between a rock and a hard place, because they always need some form of money. And Matthew off the show mentioned a great point about the cost of floodlights being used across the winter. With that in mind, could you see fixtures being moved to 1 o'clock to avoid the additional expense?
I could do, given the way things are going. Yeah, I mean, I guess the only downside for that could be that, you know, those lower leagues have so many fixtures and so many midweek fixtures, don't they? Does that then start bringing in problems for attendances? Because obviously, you know, you start moving fixtures to 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I guess, you know, how many fans can get out of work, how many fans can suddenly, you know, if they want to take their kids, they're not going to be able to do that with school. And if that starts affecting attendances, does that cause the clubs more of a problem than potentially turning the lights on for a few hours? But if this is what clubs seem to think is the best way for them and something that helps, then I think given the sort of, you know, energy crisis and times that we're in at the moment, then we've got to do everything you can to try and help.
Now, of course, Luke, these EFL clubs are not immune to the energy crisis. And when you consider that League One and Two are going to be in operation during the World Cup, are owners of the 48 clubs going to have to think outside the box during those weekend winter months?
Well, you're talking to the right man, because I actually work in the energy market.
Ah, there we go.
So you didn't know that before you invited me on, but there you go. yeah, more or less over winter. Okay, the price cap has come in and it's fairly well received in the market, but what I would say is that over winter, the costs for these clubs and their energy bills, I would say, will do anything from double to quadruple. And these aren't going to be businesses, if you like, that are particularly savvy with their energy costs. You know, it's in the past, this won't have been the biggest outgoing for the likes of, I don't know, Bristol Rovers or whoever. You know, this won't be a huge priority for them, but it's going to have to be over the next, I would say, probably looking at the way the market has gone, probably over the next sort of 3 years. And they will have to think outside of the box. And as Carl said, you know, let's be fair, this isn't just the clubs who are going to be suffering from this cost of living crisis, it's the fans as well. And if you're putting fixtures on midweek and at awkward times, they're still asking for the same amount of money, then eventually something will give. And unfortunately, I think you may start to see that people say, well, you know what, I can't actually afford that this week. I'm going to have to give that a miss. And, you know, if they're not careful, if they're not savvy over the winter, over the World Cup, it could have a pretty damning effect, really.
Well, of course. I mean, we're looking at inflation skyrocketing, and with things creeping up with inflation, there's always that danger that nothing ever really creeps back down. So football tickets could go up, and then you think, oh, well, you know, it's inflation. That's the tag around it. But then a season down the line, inflation might be at 2%, but the costs don't go down in terms of football. And that is where people go, do you know what? Enough is enough. And that is probably why the non-league scene is booming at such a pace, because for a third of the price, you can watch a good bit of honest football, really. And it's kind of, when you're doing the voting with your feet and your purse, it's a bit of a no-brainer. But I could also say that Watford have no brain, because they've sacked another manager. Carl, surely this club are beyond parody now.
We feel like we're surprised when this happens, but we really shouldn't be, should we? You know, I think we called it at the end of last season, didn't we? Saying like, well, OK, yeah, there's a new man in charge, but how long will he actually last? And I know we joked about it, but it is just becoming bizarre, isn't it? You know, the way that the club is being run. And ultimately, I think what Watford are actually doing is turning a lot of people off of the club, because, you know, Watford were one of those clubs that I think no one really had a dislike for. You know, I don't know any fan that would have said they dislike Watford, but I think the way that the club's being run, I think they are becoming one of those disliked clubs that people kind of think, oh, you get relegated. I wouldn't mind seeing you relegated because of the way that you're actually running and the way that you go about your morals. But they obviously feel they've got, well, I don't think they have got a plan, but they must feel they have. You know, Bilic could be a good appointment, couldn't he, Dan? You know, given his history and everything, who knows, maybe he'll be the one man that goes in there. But, you know, I'd agree with you, Dan. I'd give him till March and then he'll probably be gone as well.
Well, it just makes no sense, doesn't it? I mean, even if he does get them promoted, the Watford board will forget what he's done. He'll either be booted off in the summer because they'll get attracted by someone else, or he'll last 8 games in the Premier League and we just go again. And it's just so nonsensical. I mean, Luke, you look at Rob Edwards. He left Forest Green in rather acrimonious circumstances. I know Dale Vince was really unhappy with his departure. Now, he'll get a nice payout for those 11 matches, but do you reckon he now regrets going to Vicarage Road? Or when taking the job, there was always that kind of expectation that this is going to happen at some point?
Well, yeah, this is a surprise for Rob Edwards, and he's been very, very naive. I think the only, I mean, I'm, just on that, I'm surprised that this is even a talking point, really.
Well, that's true.
Is anybody really surprised by this? I mean, the only reason I would say about it is when they hired Rob Edwards, you did have that sort of feeling of, oh, are they trying to do things a little bit differently? You know, he's a young manager from the lower leagues. It's not another foreign appointment that you could just expect to go back to Spain or Italy in a couple of weeks. So I think we were kind of lulled into a false sense of security with it, really. I don't think he regrets it, to answer your question. I think it would seem to be quite inevitable for him. And he came from Forest Green and just been promoted to League One. I suspect that he'll probably be able to land another League One managerial job fairly easily after this. I don't think he's damaged his reputation too much because, you know, like I said, before he went, I think everybody expected this to happen to him.
Well, I mean, his stock's quite high. I think, if anything, when you're departing Watford, it's not really by your own fault, is it? It's just the kind of, the boards go, actually, no, we're going to change our manager. And I bet you Watford probably thought in the summer, do you know what, we're going to change tack. Let's try something different. And they've looked at it 10 matches in and thought, ah, we're not top of the table. This isn't working. It's just far too short term. Where if they'd let him on for the season, I don't see Watford finishing outside the top four. Do you know what I mean? It's just it's so early in the Championship season, as you said earlier, there's so much ebb and flow and attrition in the Championship that what you do now is never really a precursor to what happens in March and April. I think any other club could have quite easily rid this storm and still been in the playoffs coming into the season. I think it's just Watford all over. But let's move on finally to Leicester, because Brendan Rodgers somehow is still Leicester manager by the time of recording. So, Cole, this coming Monday, Leicester play host to Nottingham Forest in what is now a bottom-of-the-table clash. This surely has to be a must-win game for the former Celtic boss.
It's got to be, isn't it? I mean, I couldn't believe that he managed to survive this international break, you know, after that defeat to us, where, you know, we weren't that good, but ultimately their defending was just completely abysmal. I thought, well, that's it. He's done. You know, the international break is the perfect time to make the change. You can do what you need to and not disrupt things too much. But he's obviously got a little bit of back in there and they're prepared to sort of give this guy a chance and see if he can do it. But I would say that if they don't get the result against Forest, then I can't see how much longer they let it go, because, you know, you have got to start sitting there thinking you can't fall too far behind, where if you do want to make a change, you can't give somebody new coming in an uphill task where they're too far behind to even make a difference. So, yeah, I was very surprised. But this is a must-win game, and there must be enormous pressure on him because he must know that as well.
Absolutely. Luke, by the same token, are you surprised that Brendan Rodgers is still in the job? Because the international break is usually the perfect window for a chairman to go, right, do you know what? It's October, it's September, let's get things changed, let's get a new man in. That hasn't happened. There's still, I guess, the most minimal amount of credit in Brendan Rodgers' bank account at the moment in terms of Leicester manager. But at the same token, is he drinking in the last chance saloon before Monday?
Well, I think really that if this had been any other team in the league, I would say, yeah, absolutely. I'm surprised he's still in with a job. But they lost £120 million this summer. And that was after selling Fofana to Chelsea for £70 million. So they're in a pretty dire straits financially, unfortunately, Leicester. And ultimately, you know, one, who do they get in? Who's actually lined up to replace him? Two, who would want the job? Because clearly they won't have anything to spend. And, you know, is there anybody lined up really who knows the players as well as Brendan Rodgers does? I completely agree with you that they are fairly laughable defensively. But, you know, where do their options actually sit if not Brendan Rodgers? And I mean, defensively as well, as well as how poor they are in defence, they seem to have lost all kind of sort of conduciveness going forward. They don't seem to be able to link up with Vardy like they used to be able to do. And there seems to be wholesale changes needed. But I don't think that financially they have the resources there at the moment to do anything about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, it doesn't really bode well. I mean, Nottingham Forest themselves have conceded, 14 goals in four matches. Six of those have come against fellow promoted clubs. So they're not really in the best positions. I know we talk about them signing, pick a number, I don't know, 22 players. It could be more, could be less. But we get the kind of idea that the cohesion isn't there and the new team has to build, etc., etc. But if they lose that one, they're bottom of the table. And although Stevie Cooper's not going to be top of the list when it comes to managers in crisis, it's not quite going where he wants to go either. So it's going to be a really interesting clash on Monday. Whether Brendan Rodgers is still in charge by the time we come back next Tuesday, we'll have to wait and see, because now we've hit full time, which means I need to do the admin for the show, and it's as simple as thanking my two top guests. Luke, thanks for your time this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed that one and would like to join us again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much for having us, guys. Yeah, much appreciated.
Not a problem, mate. And Cole, thanks for wearing the captain's armband. I hope you'll join me next time.
Yeah, looking forward to it, Dan, and really enjoyed this one.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. Sports Social Podcast Network.